Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
The cow goes from KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today I have as my guest T.C. Boyle, whose new book, The Women, is, I think, one of his very best. It's published by Viking. And, well, it's a very interesting situation here, because as I was reading the book, I remembered years ago Tom saying to me, well, Michael, you haven't mentioned that the book is hilarious. Well, this book is hilarious, but most of the critics haven't mentioned that, and it changes tone. It begins, in a sense, in high opera bouffe, that's comic opera, but of that farcical sort, and it really is about watching subjects that can be taken lightly grow serious.
Absolutely, and, Michael.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. And I love your take on this. Now, we can't take these critics to task. After all, they do love me, and they do love the book, and each is giving his take on it. But perhaps they're not really getting the full depths of it, and also the tonal change which you're suggesting. Don't forget, my task here is to present the biographical facts of the life of Frank Lloyd Wright as seen through his acolytes, but yet to give a little sort of a satiric take on it, but still affect you and make it give you pathos and give you the tragedy of his life as well, and of course the tragedy of the followers. What is the effect of on someone of giving themselves over to somebody else's regime?
And not only that, it's a book about the price of pursuing freedom and the kind of funny ideas people have about freedom. One of the women in the book, the one the first part is devoted to, has given her life to a regime not once, in the case of Frank Lloyd Wright, but twice. She's been a acolyte of Gurdjieff. In fact, she has been a practitioner of the Gurdjieff dance movements.
Yes, yes.
And in fact, for all of her efforts, by a jealous former mistress, she's a dancer. He's taken up with a dancer. But these are spiritualist contortions that she does, and not in public necessarily.
Yes, of course. You're referring to Frank Lloyd Wright's last wife, Olga Vanna. One of the things I love about these historical settings is that the actual history, as I discover it through biographies and through newspaper accounts of the day, are as far-fetched and wild and interesting as anything I could invent in novels in which I'm not writing about real people. It's just tremendous fun for me. And so it is true that here's a woman who went from the devotion to Gurdjieff at Fontainebleau in Paris to having an immediate attraction to another guru, trading one for the other. And her experience with Gurdjieff and his atelier in Paris stood her in good stead when she became the Dragon Lady of Taliesin. And for the last 30 years of her life, whipped all of these young apprentices into shape and even manipulated their couplings and their romances.
Now, the book is written in collaboration by a Japanese former acolyte and his grandson.
In-law.
In-law, that's right.
In-law. In-law. It sounds preposterous, but it is. It's certainly, I had a lot of fun with this.
And all of this is being written not only after the fact, and not only mostly about periods that the young acolyte has not himself witnessed, but it's being written in reverse about the time when he was at Taliesin, followed by the time just before that, followed by the time way before that.
Yeah, this intricate structure, Michael, allows me to do several things. When I discovered it, I was very happy. For one, by telling the story of the women backwards, it allows me to change the tone and make it more somber and tragic because we end with the murder of Mema. Secondly, it enables me to reflect on love relationships. That is, as you suggest, when we first come into the book, we're viewing the final wife, Olgivanna, and the second wife, Miriam, is this harpy, this demon, whom we enjoy comically, but is also destroying her ex-husband and Olgivanna. And so, as we go progressively through it, we then come to the second chapter, second part of the book, of Miriam's part, and we see that here she is as a seductive and wonderful companion. Further, what is the truth of received history or biography? There are something like 1,000 books in print on Frank Lloyd Wright and his life and work. And even within the context of those, there are always disagreements as to what actually happened, not let alone how people felt. So by having the story told by Tadashi Sato, with his story moving forward in the form of three long introductions to each of the sections of the women, we see the full scope of Frank Lloyd Wright's life and his effect on his acolytes, so that Tadashi's story moves forward from the 30s to Frank Lloyd Wright's death in 59. But also, since he has written this in collaboration with his grandson-in-law, Seamus O'Flaherty, O'Flaherty-san, the failed Irish-American novelist, there's always a question as to what is the authenticity of this text? And so we come to the footnotes. The footnotes are written by Tadashi as he is reading this text. He has delivered a memoir in Japanese to his grandson-in-law. And his grandson-in-law has novelized the memoir. So I had tremendous fun with the footnotes. Tadashi is reacting to the text, and he's surprised by it in some cases. And that surprise may allow me to give you a joke, but it also allows me sometimes to simply correct things and to give you actual facts of Frank Lloyd Wright's existence, the houses he built, where he was at a given period.
But as we go along, what we're seeing is that the idealized Frank Lloyd Wright, the man that these acolytes have come to study and live with, is very rarely available to them. In fact, when he finds it charming to be respectful to Japanese culture, Frank Lloyd Wright is rather capable of putting on a show. But when it comes to helping his draftsman and virtual personal slave to be rescued from internment after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, well, you know, another story entirely.
Well, I don't agree exactly. Frank Lloyd Wright, the historical figure, not my character, was anti-war and did help two of his apprentices escape to Canada to avoid service in World War II. The internment of Tadashi, of course, is fictionalized. Tadashi is an invented character, and yet in my telling, Frank Lloyd Wright at least tries to help him. I do think that the character I've created, based on the true character of Frank Lloyd Wright, did have an interest occasionally in someone beyond himself. But of course, the icon of Frank Lloyd Wright, whom we know as an historical figure, interests me because he is clearly a narcissistic personality whose invention and whose art depends upon the application of many other people to whom he doesn't really give much back. The same thing was true of my portrait of Alfred C. Kinsey in The Inner Circle or of John Harvey Kellogg in The Road to Wellville. These figures fascinate me because they're sociopathic to a degree. There's a further question that this raises about ethics and art. I feel that it doesn't really matter who makes the art or what their personality is. The art is independent of any consideration. And yet, as we said at the outset, I'm always wondering about what is the effect of this artist and his personality on the people who give themselves up to him.
I think that also, though, there's a quality in your work that depends upon the reader finding the moral vantage point on the characters. The stories are complicated because you're not going to give them that vantage point, but there is a point where you find where you're situated and see, oh, you know, the B-boy has been wounded more than wounding. And in this book, too, we're watching a Frank Lloyd Wright character who repeatedly has homilies to give about the American home and what it means, about the hearth, how warm it is, about how important it is for the family to gather together around this hearth while he is
running off and deserting his wife and children with a $900 grocery bill. Yes.
Yes.
Of course.
And regularly and repeatedly. And more and more so. He's a man with a repetition compulsion.
And defending it to the press in press conferences, defending the fact that he's left his wife and family and established a mistress at Taliesin and is living with her in sin. And as you say, he did this twice with two different mistresses. Three times, actually, if you include Olgivanna. He defends himself as being above the common morality after the fact.
And we do believe, you and I both, that an artist can be above the common morality, but that his own life shouldn't be contradicted by his statements and prescriptions for others, yes?
Of course. I think no artist can give prescriptions for any other artist. But he lived with women outside of wedlock. In the time we're talking about, in the early part of the last century through the teens and 20s, this made him a pariah. He stood outside of society. But of course, in our day, it wouldn't be such a big deal.
We wouldn't care, but this book has it at its heart to present, particularly his wife, Kitty, someone vulnerable, having his children, receiving promises from him. And so we start to see that this, at the very least, is not fair play.
Yes,
of course. He's not being right.
Right, of course. But as you said earlier, there has to be a subtlety in art that invites the reader's participation to the highest degree. And so it's not that I don't have confirmed opinions with regard to art and ethics. It's that I want the reader to
discover them.
Discover them, exactly. Yes.
And I think that's what this book does. At every turn, it's asking us to decide whether we really, for all of the iconicity of the Frank Lloyd Wright character, want to believe as totally as the other people in his life in this architect who never masters wiring so that his own house is constantly burning down. Three times.
Yeah, but you know, the historical figure is a very complex figure. He must have been incredibly dynamic, as many great men are. If he were here joining us in this show, neither you nor I would have spoken yet. You know, I believe he was just this powerful figure. He had a lot of fun with his own image, though. For instance, the quote that opens the book. This is one of his many bon mots. He played with his own image. He loved public attention, sort of like the bad boy in class who, if he's not getting attention for being good, he'll get it for being bad. He'll act out. Yes, I don't really think that he appreciated the fact that his sexual life was spread across the newspapers in tabloid hell in his day. I mean, he was sort of like the Octomom and OJ rolled in one for his era, you know. But he wanted attention.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with T.C. Boyle, author, most recently, of The Women, published by Viking. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with T.C. Boyle about his new novel, The Women. Now, as I've come to know you over the years and have heard about how you teach and know something of how you live, I think that the image of Frank Lloyd Wright is something like the image of T.C. Boyle.
Obviously, Michael, I write these stories as cautionary tales. I want to be a good guru. I don't want to lead anybody to anything. I want them to appreciate art. And I want to be an artist who continues to find new ways to tell a story.
But I think as an image, T.C. Boyle is something of a wild man. He's known to be arrogant and wants to be a rock star of literature. But in truth, he's a diligent writer of books that take a lot of time to write. He's a believer with his students in the well and carefully plotted book, involving as well a moral viewpoint, a place that satire originates from. And I see the characters, especially Frank Lloyd Wright and the women, as being wrestling with T.C. Boyle.
Of course.
I am
of
a bad
boy. Of course.
There is no viewpoint where I can be judged.
I love this, Michael.
Yes.
So I write about Kinsey. I write about Kellogg. I write about figures who are grandiose in some respect. We are all contradictory. I certainly would never have come before you when we first met and first talked about the first of my books or talked to anyone else without absolute confidence in my art. Art is all that matters. My public persona, I have fun with it. I love to perform. I love to shake audiences up. I like to, in conversation, say the odd thing, remind everybody of the absurdity of life. You know, life isn't necessarily – conversation isn't necessarily have a nice day, you too. It's much more than that. So what if I had a bad boy persona when I was younger? It has nothing to do with my art. If it attracts people to the art – so much the better.
But then in the third section, we're going to get clobbered, because although it takes place chronologically first, Frank Lloyd Wright and his first mistress, Mema, have hired a couple from Barbados, and they do go crazy there and murder.
This is the essential tragedy of Frank Lloyd Wright's life. Amazingly resilient man, of course, because within 6 months of Mema's death, he was allied with Miriam. Nonetheless, here we have he'd given everything for Mema. They were outcasts. He built Taliesin for her. Now it has all been destroyed. Julian Carleton went mad, killed Mema, her two children from her previous marriage, with a shingling hatchet, nailed the windows of Taliesin shut, set the rugs on fire, and killed four of the other workers there, and then he eventually died himself. You know that this has happened because there are references to it throughout the backward-spinning narrative, and I think if I'm doing my job, it should produce a sense of dread in the reader. And that dread, I hope, is fulfilled, or you get a catharsis from this when the book ends on the tragic note. And yet, as you may have noticed, my discovery was that then Miriam would reappear again. In her earliest incarnation, so that the whole cycle sweeps back again and around, and with the suggestion that it will be cyclical in the structure of this particular book.
Yes, and though we've been lulled into laughing easily at certain kinds of women, certain kinds of presumptions of artists, certain kinds of pretension. It's almost as if the book has been very sneakily unlocking the doors of political correctness and letting us laugh at things that we haven't been allowed to laugh at for a long time. And then we're going to have to figure out how do we laugh at this deranged Barbadian black man.
And we don't.
We don't.
We are absolutely horrified. And in the histories of this and the biographies of Frank Lloyd Wright, we don't know exactly why Julian Carleton did what he did. But in my scenario, it plays in, of course, with the theme of racism and the racism that we see Tadashi experiencing. And to me, it made it very credible. And further, it also intersects with Mema's feminism. In the incident which really sparks it, she objects to her servant's treatment of his own wife on feminist principles. And he is also then an object of racism amongst the other apprentices.
And so this becomes very complicated because as it narrows to that first chronological point, an upheaval, an uprising that's going to unsettle all sorts of values that we've been assuming through the book. This is also the part where the Japanese narrator is revealing to us that his life has robbed him of his pleasures one by one.
Yeah, it was incredibly sad for me to bring these elements together at the end. But again, they've all been laid out carefully as the book progresses so that when Tadashi reflects in the footnotes at the end, the footnotes previously had been, as I said, a joke or
a correction.
Informative or a correction. Now they are very personal and tragic because he is reflecting on the death of his own son and his own losses in contradistinction to what Raito-san, Frank Lloyd Wright, is experiencing and what Mema has experienced.
I think a lot of something I saw, and I liked her confidence, something I saw Jamaica Kincaid say in front of an audience she was speaking to. She said, yes, you Americans like to laugh, but you never know how to stop. And that's sort of what this book is about, that laughter, we need the right to laugh, but we also need to be able to have the moral compass that lets us know when laughter is not in order or when laughter goes out of order. And I think that's what this book does, interestingly.
I think you're hitting it right on the head beautifully, Michael. I agree. My relationship to life is that of the satirist and the humorist. But it's always laughing in the dark, of course. Look at the parameters of human life. My principal theme throughout the books, I suppose, would be one that has to deal with our nature as animals, our animal nature as opposed to our intellectual or spiritual nature.
Okay. Now I want to ask a final question, and it's a serious one here. When one reads the critics writing about the book, they essentially say novelization of the life of Frank Lloyd Wright. As we see here, it's a specific part of the life of Frank Lloyd Wright from a specific point of view, but in particular what we've been talking about is design, the design of a novel, because the mastery of the facts is only the beginning. It's the design that gives us the novel. Otherwise, we could read a biography of Frank Lloyd Wright.
Which is perhaps why you're so engaged with this one. The other two figures I wrote about were scientists. And, of course, I love to pursue science. But now I'm writing about an artist who is a master of design. And I'm always searching for design. You know me well. I work organically. I work intuitively. I don't know what it will be until I arrive there, day by day, step by step, brick by brick, if you will. The design is all. The design is the art. And so that's what I'm trying to discover. I may use something, some fact in order to find a design, in order to, the fact will reveal itself.
But we're living in a time where everyone acknowledges it. Not only are there fewer readers, the readers that there are read less well, present company, I hope, excluded. But, you know, everyone talks about it. And criticism is, in a sense, reading in public. So that you're seeing how little of your design is getting registered.
Remember Kafka's The Hunger Artist, in which we have a man who performed the greatest feats of fasting in history. And fasting as a public spectacle was huge. Everyone came to see the man fasting. They even had guardians to make sure that he didn't eat on the sly, and people came to poke him in the ribs, and everything was wonderful. But then taste changed. And no one really cared about fasting. And yet here we have the hunger artist still in his cage fasting, because that's what his art is. That's what he does. And he fasts and sets astonishing records. But after a while, no one cares enough even to change the sheet of how many days he's been fasting. That's what we're facing. That's what I'm doing. I'm an artist. I'm a hunger artist, you know, and I'm starving. But I will continue to starve because that's my life. That's what I do.
So you'll be there even if the audience goes away, and even if the aestheticians who will see if you're starving yourself right have left the premises.
I cannot help but do what I do. In the essay on my website, This Monkey My Back, about my aesthetic, I do talk about it as a kind of addiction, an addiction to design, to having something come together from nothing. There's a joy in that that is indescribable.
I've been talking with T.C. Boyle, author most recently of The Women, published by Viking. Thank you, Tom, for joining me.
You're welcome, Michael.
You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.